Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and of course we are going back to zero COVID. We are going to discuss the pursuit of zero COVID. But before we do that, I just want to let listeners know again that patreon.com/tortoiseshack, an enormous amount of content has come out only in the last 24 hours. I would say to people, check out the latest episode, The Police is Back. Police is Back, and it's a fabulous episode with Israel, and he tells his story, and he's a good friend of George Inchenko, and he, look, I don't know, I don't want to go into it too much, just listen to him in his own words, really, really can't tell you enough. Go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, and you'll find Police there, probably the top of the page. Have a listen, really well worth your time. Anyway, Martin, how are you keeping?
Not too bad, Tony. Not too bad. And look, folks, if you could see Tony, he's skeletal at this stage from all the work he's doing. So, you know, stick your hand in your pocket.
I'm eating like a 16-year-old. I have bags of crisps on my desk now. Anyway, we are delighted to be rejoined by friend of the pod. And I believe we're going to quote Martin here before we came on.
I'll say it myself. My favorite Gaeler.
Yeah. Professor Anthony Staines rejoins us. Anthony, how are things? It's been a crazy busy week for you guys in the independent scientific advocacy group. Yes.
Yeah, it has. But I mean, where things are is with very high rate of COVID. It's been going up for the last few days, but hopefully that's a glitch, and it will keep going down. And there has been a lot of discussion suddenly about making zero COVID real. And what, you know, what does that imply? And the two big issues that come up are the Northern Ireland border and quarantine at hotels. There hasn't been much discussion of a third issue, which is actually empowering regional public health to do its job. So at the minute in Ireland, we have a contact tracing network, which is run out of call centres. And the work they do is useful, but it's not nearly enough. So you look at our figures, it says most of our cases are community transmission, which is a really polite way of saying we have no idea where these people got infected. And we haven't asked the questions to find out. In Australia, they will do things like put out a warning saying, were you on this bus going from here to there at this time? If so, get a test. We are light years from that. But we should be much closer to it. So there's a few bits to actually doing this right. And it's the nature of public health. We need to do all of them.
Am I right in understanding that the way our contact tracing is at the moment is we're not tracing close contacts because we can't, we simply haven't got the capacity. And also that the traces are only going back 2 days. There was a plan to go back 7 days during the summer, but it never materialized. So they're only going back 2 days. So if they say there is an outbreak in a hospital or a care facility, that it's automatic, the tests only go back 2 days. So it automatically looks like it comes from that facility. But if you went back further, that's not necessarily the case. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's right. And it's a significant issue for schools as well. Because if you start to feel ill over a weekend, as many a child does, you're brought to the GP on Monday, you're tested maybe Monday afternoon. The testing is now really slick and you'll have the result back Tuesday morning. But you won't be recorded as being connected with school because you weren't in school Saturday, Sunday or Monday. And that's one of the real challenges. And the hospitality industry keeps raising the very reasonable question. If they're such a problem, why are there so few cases linked to hospitality? And the reason is that we're not asking the question. So we actually don't know where the risk points in our society are. We're using results from other countries that have done this better and done this more thoroughly. And that's better than nothing. But it would be much better, again, if we actually knew in our society in detail where cases were rising. We hear anecdotes. People tell me of county finals in Cavan and All-Ireland final celebrations in Mayo triggering major outbreaks. But we're not asking the questions that would allow us to say, yeah, that's true. Or no, actually, that's not true. That's not the problem. What is the problem? Let's deal with the problem.
Anthony, just understand this. That is clear that we've never really had test, track and trace at the level that we needed. Even in the summer when we had the opportunity, as you guys have often said, we were a couple of weeks away from moving for suppression and eradication, moving towards that, and we didn't do it. Empowering the local health services, in regional health services, as you propose now. How quickly can something like that ramp up? Because I know you're a huge advocate for making this our last lockdown.
Yes, it can ramp up relatively quickly. What we need to do is we need to train a whole bunch of contact tracers who will work for the local public health people. And we need an information system that will connect them all together and connect them to the call centres. The tools in the call centres were built in about 14 days. I don't know any reason why we can't roll those tools out more widely and make them available to everybody. Training the people, you can train people to do contact tracing well in a day.
Okay.
You take people who have, you know, reasonable interpersonal skills. Journalists are great contact tracers, incidentally. So are hospitality staff. Barmen are really good at it. People who can ask other people questions and listen to the answers and have a bit of cup and can put the answers together.
So
that's what you need.
So not politicians then.
I refuse to comment on that. They tend to incriminate me.
We're trying to drag him into waters he doesn't want to go, Martin.
Can I just ask, and I'm going to say about schools specifically, whether this is true or not, but it's not necessarily about the children in school. It's the movement of 1.1 million people every day in the process of getting children to school is where the real risk factor is. And that, you know, there seems to be a bit of the picture that's got lost, which is it's the movement of people you need to restrict, not necessarily the shutting down of everything. The two things aren't necessarily the same.
It's the contacts between households. And certainly, there are viruses where children are central to the spread. This is not one of those. But children do contribute to the spread. So you're right. It is the parents meeting at the schools. That is certainly a contributor. It is people gathering around, collecting kids from the school afterwards. That's certainly a feature. But it's also kids in public transport meeting adults who are also traveling in public transport to, you know, to their work and exchanging viruses. So we've got to a point where we've actually closed pretty much all the schools, and there's a big issue about the special schools. So these are schools for children largely with intellectual disabilities. And they have a very specific set of needs. They have a very specific type of teaching, much more hands-on, much more personal care involved for some of the kids. And they are being left high and dry by everything that's gone on. I think Ronan Glynn said today, if I remember correctly, that opening those schools would bring maybe 2-3% of the school population back into circulation. And that wasn't something that would cause him worry or concern.
He did say that.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, no, you're quite right. He did say that. And in terms of people circulating, it would be quite small. It obviously has spilt over into the realm of politics, and it has got quite nasty between some of the rhetoric and discourse and some of the statements from the department. And that, you know, we've spoken to special needs assistants, we've spoken to teachers, we spoke to a school principal who also is the parent of a child with special needs, and she was quite upset by some of the rhetoric. So I don't want to necessarily go into that other than to say communications has been a bit of a disaster on this. I do want to move on to the two things since the last time we spoke, and we've spoke now a few times. The zero COVID has finally grasped the zeitgeist. And like, you know, we know it couldn't have happened without me and Martin, but nonetheless, we won't. But we've spoken to your colleagues in the independent science advocacy group. You know, we've spoken to Aoife, we've spoken to Julian, we've spoken to Tomás, and the ability of this message to now percolate up and take root with the general public has happened. But you've put at the outset of this conversation, you said, but the border is this thing. Can you just give us sort of 90 seconds, in your opinion, of how, while the border is not ideal, how we can actually, you know, whether it's a bubble system or whatever the system is, how we can deal with it? Because I'd love to clip it and play it all over the country for every fellow who says, but the border.
We copy more or less what they did in Australia, where they closed the borders between the states for the first time in over a century. So you deal with the people who live very close to the border. A lot of towns are bisected by the border. And you say to those people, you can go across as you wish. You deal with people who work across the border. If you're an essential worker working the other side of the border, here is a pass, you can wave it and go through the checkpoint. Everyone else, you do pretty much what we're doing on the Cork-Kerry border or the Dublin-Kildare border. You have checkpoints and the guards ask you, you're more than 5 kilometres from home, where are you going? And if you're going to get the shopping for your mother, off you go. But if you're going to meet 3 friends for a drink in their house, go back. And that's how you do it. It's you can't close the border. That the British Army couldn't close the border. And I assure you, the massed forces of Irish Public Health certainly can't close the border. So that's how you do it. Light touch, sensible, responsive, with great respect to the communities close to the border on both sides. Ideally, we coordinate both sides of the border, but actually either side can do this on their own.
Can I ask about those who are of the mindset that we can jab our way out of this? Indeed, I'll refer to an ad that says jab and go, but there isn't a jab and go in this. This is not how getting to the vaccination levels we need works. Am I right about that?
You're right. I mean, there's 3 different pieces of that. So maybe take them in order. The first is we don't really know if this vaccination stops you becoming infected and stops you spreading the virus. We do know that it stops you getting seriously ill, which is great. We do know it greatly reduces your risk of dying, which is fantastic. But we don't know yet whether it stops you spreading, and we're not going to know for some time. It's being actively studied. Watch this space is all I can say on that. We will see. So the second thing is the time. The government says it's going to take to the end of September to vaccinate 70% of the Irish population, which, you know, for us is a realistic and a good timescale. It's achievable, given supplies. If we had a boat full of vaccine doses off the East Wall, we could do it faster. We don't. So by September, we'll have 70% vaccinated. The objective of vaccination is to protect people who are vaccinated, but it's also to stop the virus circulating. Because the people most likely to get sick and die are elderly people, people who are immunosuppressed, people like me who've had transplants, are all at risk of not responding to the vaccine. So I am going to get vaccinated as soon as my turn comes up, but there is more risk that I will still be vulnerable to the virus after vaccination than there is that someone else of my age will be vulnerable. So that's the second part. We don't know how people are protected until we've vaccinated a large number of people. We don't know how many people we need to vaccinate. There's a city called Manaus in Brazil, which has been intensively studied because of a truly appalling series of tragedies. And Manaus is a small city about the size of Dublin in Amazonia, so it's quite cut off from other major cities. They had a series of major outbreaks of coronavirus. Their most recent outbreak, which is happening as I speak to you, where they were running out of oxygen in their hospitals the other day, started when 3/4 of the population had been infected. So this major outbreak has occurred in the remaining quarter of the population, despite three quarters of the population being infected. The worry there is we may need to vaccinate well over 80% of our population to stop the virus circulating. But we don't know, and we're not going to know for some time. The target at the moment is 80%, but we may need to go higher. So the third thing that worries people is also connected to variants of the virus. So the virus generates new variants, new types as it goes along. This is natural. This is normal. All viruses do this. And this one has generated a number of variants which are more transmissible. So the one we've all heard about is B117, which is also called the UK variant. And now I think roughly half or a bit less than half our cases are of this variant. And that has happened since the beginning of December. So it's gone from practically none to more than half or close to half. It was probably helped by 50,000 people coming into the country over Christmas.
I just want to point out to listeners, this is the exact same impact that they've seen in Dubai in the last few days as well, but whereby the winter sun crowd came, visited, left, and now they have huge outbreaks of the B117 variant.
So that's a real issue. There's a variant 502Y1, which was identified in South Africa, and there's a variant P1, which was identified in Brazil, both of which are more transmissible. So they spread more. And if that means all other things being equal, you get more cases. They're not more dangerous. The outcome is the same. But because you get more cases, you get more sick people, and you get more, unfortunately, you get more deaths. But that's not what really worries people. What really worries us is this. Those two strains, the South African strain and the Brazilian strain, look different in the site that our vaccine protects against. Now, I'm not a structural biologist, fairly obviously, but the structural biologists have looked at it, the virologists have looked at it, and what they have said is they are concerned that this virus may not be covered by our vaccines. And there are some laboratory experiments, and these are in test tubes, not in people, a very different world, but they suggest those concerns might be real. We're not going to know for some time. And if the worst comes to the worst, if our vaccines only provide partial protection against these, the vaccine technology we're using now, we can produce a new vaccine fairly sharpish. So it's not the end of the world. It's not a disaster. It's a delay. But what that delay mean, what all of those delays mean is this. We're not going to bring the virus under control with vaccination till October at the earliest, if everything goes well. We might not be able to bring it under control with vaccination for 18 months. While we're not bringing it under control with vaccination, what we will get is recurring cycles like the one we're living through now, where the number of cases spikes, hospital admissions spike, we bring in lockdowns, you bring in restrictions, and we're kind of back where we started. And every one of those lockdowns hits jobs, hits businesses, as well as generating sickness and unfortunately deaths. More of those we have, the more economic damage we get.
It would be a huge failure of civilization to get to achieve so much so quickly and then to let it slip away for undetermined purposes, for weighing, balancing things that shouldn't be balanced. It would be a huge failure if we got a variant that we had to go again and get a vaccine for. It would be a massive failure. So on one hand, we have this risky playing with fire strategy, and on the other hand, we can go for zero COVID. Do you now think it's inevitable that the government is going to have to do this?
It's not inevitable. I mean, I'm not elected. The government is elected. They have to make the choice. My sense of European governments, and I work with the European group who've been engaging with governments all across Europe over the last 10 days or so, And our sense from those conversations is that European governments are realizing that what they've done up to now has failed, and they need to do something different. Whether they will come out and say that is unclear. How long it will all take is unclear. But the scientists have done their bit. I cannot say to you how much of a miracle it is that we have what seems to be a really good vaccine, and not just one, but three and more potentially coming, for a virus that was first identified in January of last year. A year and a week ago, the sequence of this virus was first written down on a piece of paper. Now we have a vaccine for it. That is the fastest we've ever got a vaccine out before is 4 years. Usually they take 8 to 10 years. So the scientists have done their bit. The medics have done their bit. The public health people have done their bit. The virologists have done their bit. The public have done their bit. If you look at the figures in Ireland, the number of cases was going down. The number of contacts has fallen very sharply. So the public are doing what they're asked to do. And opinion polls show very strong support for bringing the virus under control. And people understand that there's no free way of controlling the virus. There's a price for it, be that hotel quarantine, be that a level of continuing social restriction. But I think all the opinion polls say the same thing. People understand that we need to control this virus, and we should control this virus. And it's now over to our government, over to our elected representatives, to make the decision. We have done huge work on the public health side showing that it's technically feasible to do this. My vaccine colleagues have created the vaccines, created the technologies. My clinical colleagues are working miracles, curing people in hospitals. The survival rate for people with COVID-19 in Irish hospitals is as good as anywhere else in the world and better than most. So our clinical colleagues have done an amazing job despite 19th century hospitals, despite all the challenges of the health service. They've done an amazing job. It is now on the government's plate. It is now up. Ultimately, it's up to Micheál Martin to make the call on this. Now, Martin has form in public health. He will be famous forever as the politician who brought in the smoking ban, a ban which was copied all across the world within 2 years. That has saved tens of thousands of lives. This is his chance to show leadership. Because I think the European countries are looking for someone to jump first.
Yes.
And why, you know, let's us jump first.
Why shouldn't it be the island that does it? And I read a great, and I can't think of the, it was a sociologist, but I can't think of who I'm ripping off. So I'll take credit for it anyway. But he said, we're a civilization in search of its humanity. And there's an element of that whereby above, and what they meant in the grander context is as in Western civilization, because that's where it's really failed. It's failed in the EU and it's failed in the US. And we're in search of our humanity as opposed to this argument that we've had for 11 months about economy versus lives, this nonsense now. And I think that argument has gotten less and less and less. And I did see a column, an opinion writer debating as if he was an expert last night on TV, which is kind of disappointing that we're still at that stage. But nonetheless, I think the discourse publicly has moved on. The last thing from my point of view, though, is in terms of the numbers that we're seeing, you said that you saw them come down and now they've come back up again. We've seen the R number being quoted at somewhere between 0.5 to 0.8, but less than one. But we've also got concerns around these new variants making the R number unreliable. Is that fair to say that we may actually, because it's more transmissible now, we don't actually know really where we are particularly well?
We have some idea. I mean, the R is an average across all the infections and all the strains and all the people. So it's quite possible that the R number for the existing strains is quite low, that they're not reproducing very well. and the R number for the new strain could still be a little bit above one. But we can almost certainly push it to below one and keep it there. It involves work, it involves effort, and it involves, one of my colleagues had a nice metaphor. They said it's like having a forest fire, and you're controlling the fire, but over there, there's another fire burning, and there's sparks coming from it and landing in the place you're trying to stop the fire. You know, that's what it's like. We have to stop the sparks, and every country has to do that. And if you think about it, if we can stop transmission for two cycles of the virus, which is roughly a month, it goes away. Its natural host appears to be a bat living inoffensively in a tree somewhere in southern China. And that's fine. The bat seems very happy with it. We're not its natural host. It is causing, we are beginning to see the full scope of the harm of this infection. There's a genuinely frightening paper from the UK Office for National Statistics published last week. And they've looked at a very large number of people in the UK who were diagnosed with COVID. They have high hospitalization rates. They have high rehospitalization rates. And they have long-term symptoms. Maybe a third of them have significant long-term symptoms. We do not want everyone in our society to get this virus. We really don't. The symptoms are very unpredictable. Most people are reasonably lucky, but maybe a third of people, maybe 20% of people, maybe only 10% of people are left with significant long-term symptoms. I have a friend who is an ICU nurse who in the States, got this at work, not terribly sick with it, and is still out of work 10 months later and is beginning to recover now. Fit, healthy young woman. And I could multiply stories like that.
Yeah.
Until you threw a microphone.
I don't know if you noticed this week we had Claire Toomey on from it's a long COVID support group, the COVID Cases Ireland. Yeah. She spoke about how it's had a profound impact on her life and that of many of the people who she now they help one another, and they're looking for that support. And as you said, they have had life-altering, it's a life-altering illness for many of them, and it's certainly life-impacting. Sorry, Martin, I cut across you.
I was just going to say, Anthony, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us. And when the government does eventually go zero COVID, it's worth remembering that success has many fathers, and you are one of them. So thank you again.
You'll share the credit with the tortoise shack as well.
I hope listeners get a lot out of this. I know Anthony's always been very good with his time, and we do appreciate that. But I do think people have to understand that the onus is still on us in the next few weeks. It really is. We need to continue to do what has to be done. And every time someone says, "But the border," tell them what Anthony said. It can be done. It's not ideal, but it can be done. Talk to you all soon, folks. Take care. Bye bye.
Thank you very much.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.